A lot of schools are out for the summer, but here in California, where schools have faced big budget cuts, there's work to do. Many communities will spend the summer raising cash to avoid more cuts. As Lisa Napoli reports, fundraising is the new reality for some public schools.
Yearbook day at Lincoln Middle School in Santa Monica. This semester, classes ended a week early because of teacher and staff furloughs.
Thank you all for being here tonight.
A couple blocks away at the Santa Monica Malibu School Board headquarters, even though it's June, parents have kicked into stealth fundraising mode at this emergency meeting. After a local ballot initiative that would have raised money for education failed to win the necessary majority last month, the school budget was slashed by $7 million. It had been pared down by over $4.5 million the year before. Linda Gross runs the private education foundation that supports this district. She says they have 60 days to raise as much money as possible.
Usually in a normal fundraising campaign, we set a goal that's been well thought out, well researched. We don't have the luxury of time to do that.
What they have is plenty of ideas, a viral video campaign, special appeals to wealthy alumni and local businesses, fundraising parties and booths at the mall. Parent Liz Dubelman didn't bargain for any of this when she moved to pricey Santa Monica for the public schools she'd heard were great. She said she was shocked to find out private funds are relied on to pay for everything from pencils and paper towels to staff.
The idea that we have to donate for teachers' salary was mind-blowing to me.
Parents all over California have been learning that even if they live in wealthy communities, public education's going to cost them extra. Residents of affluent San Marino near Pasadena pay $4,000 to $5,000 in extra parcel taxes and donations to offset public school there. Some parents feel that's a bargain compared to the $30,000 a year private school tuition can set them back. These days, 600 of the state's 1,000 school districts supplement dwindling state budgets with private nonprofit foundations. Fundraising consultant Tim Shaw says this is not your mother's PTA.
The days of a completely free public education are over. Bake sales and candy sales and magazine sales and car washes, that doesn't cut it anymore. When you're talking multi-million dollar budget deficits, you need more sophisticated fundraising and revenue methods.
Shaw says communities can't wait for governments to fix school funding. They need to be raising money and endowments the way universities do.
As they mobilize for an intense summer, parents and friends of the Santa Monica Malibu Unified School District are assigning tasks and rallying morale. In just 2 weeks, $300,000 has poured in. That'll bring back 6 teaching positions. This was no consolation to pink-slipped elementary school teacher Monica McCauley. She's here as both an educator and a mother of a teenage son in the district's high school, and she can't believe it's come to this.
We're seeing children put up lemonade stands with the Save Our Teachers posters on there, and it's very, very unfortunate.
But even worse off, McCauley said, are the school districts that don't have the built-in wealth and resources like this one. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Napoli in Los Angeles.
And now a sports story that is not World Cup related. At Wimbledon, a truly epic tennis match set to span 3 days. American John Isner and Frenchman Nicolas Mahut have so far racked up 10 hours on the court. This breaks the previous record for the longest tennis match by about 3.5 hours. Isner and Mahut began playing last night, but the match was suspended because of darkness after 4 sets. They resumed play today, but after 118 games in the 5th set, their match was suspended once again because of darkness. They are currently tied 59-59. And joining us from Wimbledon to talk about this is Bud Collins, sports columnist for the Boston Globe. Bud, great to hear from you again.
You know, nothing like this has ever happened. Here we are at Wimbledon, which is the oldest home of tournament tennis since 1877. And there's never been anything happen like this at Wimbledon. And this match isn't over, Robert, as you point out. Maybe it will never end.
Now, for our listeners who don't know much about tennis, you have to explain, they're not playing continuously. They do get some breaks here.
Yeah, but it's pretty much, it was stopped again by darkness. It's starting to be a version of Long Day's Journey into Night, because that's happened twice. And the guys playing it have been serving aces. The aces have been falling like hailstones. They just 98 aces for John Isner, and his opponent has 94. So we've never seen aces fall like that. The previous record was 78, and there Isner tops it by 20, and he'll have more tomorrow.
Now, Isner and Mayu, we're not talking Federer and Nadal here. These are not household names. Who are these two players?
Well, that's right. John Isner, 3 years ago, he was playing for the University of Georgia and led the team to the NCAA championship, and then he turned pro. And he is 6'9" tall, the tallest American tennis player ever. And he was really a gangling, kind of awkward kid. But now he's becoming, well, maybe he'll be the best American player within a couple of years.
Uh-huh.
And he's looked awfully good. At one time, all he could do was serve. It was like hitting the ball from the top of a tree. But he's picked up the entire game.
And Mayu, what do you know about him, the Frenchman?
Well, he's an outsider. He qualified for the tournament. He comes from Angers in France, and he ranks 148th in the world. So he had to qualify to get into the tournament. But once he got there, he's been a different guy.
So the outcome of the whole tournament really doesn't hinge on this particular match, is what you're saying.
Oh, no. It's helpful, but it was funny that Roger Federer today played, nobody was paying any attention, and he was close to losing for a while, and there were others. Andy Roddick played. He played his best match of the tournament so far,
and this was it.
Again, the endless tennis match really stood them aside.
Bud Collins, thank you very much for talking with us. Bud Collins, sports columnist for the Boston Globe and analyst for the Tennis Channel from Wimbledon.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News.
The latest report on the housing market is not good. Sales of existing homes for the month of May fell, and that's despite low interest rates, lower home prices, and the government's tax credit. The sluggishness in the housing market is frustrating to real estate agents. They're bracing for a tough summer. NPR's Joshua Brockman reports.
Selma Jaeger has sold real estate for 38 years and has the trophies and plaques to prove it. But it's hardly a trophy moment in Prince George's County, Maryland, which borders Washington, D.C. Jaeger says most of her listings have been sitting on the market for months.
I'm calling it a declining market. The prices from the seller's point of view are going down, dwindling, declining, and the buyers feel that the prices are too high. And that's the problem.
What's all that doing for your business?
Tough.
This tough market is especially exasperating for realtors, because home prices are the lowest they've been in ages, and interest rates are also at historic lows. In fact, mortgage payments on a median price home fell below 20% of median household income. That's the lowest level in nearly 40 years, according to a recent report by Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. Nicholas Ritsinas, the center's director, says the implosion of the housing market hurt many people, but first-time homebuyers have emerged as winners because owning a home is now within reach.
But now with prices falling back to levels that were last seen in the beginning of this decade, with interest rates at historic lows, if they have good credit, and that's a big if, owning a home now becomes an option.
Just keep going straight ahead. You're going to be staying out in 450, okay?
Here in the Maryland suburbs, Selma Jaeger is giving me a tour of homes she's trying to sell. Our destination is a brick house on a quiet block. It's been on the market for nearly 280 days. So, in an effort to move things along, Selma Jaeger added this message to the for sale sign in the front lawn.
I'm gorgeous inside. On this main level, we have 3 bedrooms and 2 baths. So this is the whole bath.
The price started at $349,000. Then they dropped it by $20,000. It may move lower still. That's because it's competing with many houses that banks now own and are trying to unload at rock-bottom prices. Ritsinas of Harvard says a third of all U.S. sales presently fall into this category of foreclosures and short sales.
We're not going to have a sustainable housing market where such a large number of sales are distressed sales.
Selma Jaeger says at least 2 of her 9 listings have been on the market for more than 1 year. So, to stay upbeat, she throws anniversary parties.
At our weekly sales meeting, I bring in cake and ice cream, just like you'd celebrate an anniversary. Unfortunately, it's not a happy celebration, though, because that means I've had the house on the market for longer than a year.
One thing home buyers can celebrate is low mortgage rates. Keith Gumbinger, a mortgage analyst for HSH.com, says rates have benefited from economic turmoil overseas as investors shifted money into the safety of U.S. Treasury bonds.
Low and stable mortgage rates are providing important supports to the housing market. With the ending of the tax credit offer this spring, demand has fallen off to some degree.
He's referring to a federal tax credit that was intended to jumpstart the housing market, but it ended in April. Home buyers with a binding sales contract have until the end of June to complete the paperwork. Realtors like Jaeger hope that buyers will take the plunge this summer, even without the federal incentive. Joshua Brockman, NPR News.
In his ruling, Judge Martin Feldman referred to a group of experts in the oil and gas industry who the Obama administration consulted before issuing its moratorium. A number of those experts were upset when the moratorium was put in place. They felt their views had been misrepresented by Interior Secretary Ken Salazar. NPR's John Itzde joins us to tell us more about this. Good morning.
Hi, Renee.
Let's back up, though, a bit, if you don't mind, and tell us how these experts got involved in the first place.
Well, after the accident, but before instituting the moratorium, the Interior Department asked a number of outside experts to review a set of recommendations it had worked up to make deep water drilling safer. The experts agreed and signed off on a number of changes the Interior Department wanted to make. Those experts say the recommendations they reviewed made no mention of a 6-month moratorium on deep water drilling. But when Secretary Salazar issued his report with the recommendations on May 27th, he also included a call for the 6-month moratorium, which the president okayed. And Salazar included a sentence in the report implying that the experts backed the moratorium. Well, 8 of those experts said, wait a minute, we never endorsed a blanket moratorium. It wasn't even mentioned in the documents we reviewed. Judge Feldman pointed this out in his decision yesterday and was clearly troubled by it. He actually uses it as evidence of the flawed nature of the moratorium.
So these experts feel there's no need for a moratorium.
Well, not exactly. What they think is that a blanket moratorium that shuts down all deep water drilling is unnecessary and could even undermine safety in some ways. They'd like a more targeted moratorium. I've talked to several of them over the past few days, and what they say is that most of the operators and the rigs in the Gulf have been drilling in a safe manner. And with some new safety measures added since the spill, they should be able to continue to drill. But these experts say there are some rigs and wells that are more problematic. They've had some safety lapses, just as Deepwater Horizon did before it exploded. They say those rigs and operators should be placed under a drilling moratorium. And a lot of people in the drilling industry agree this would be a reasonable approach.
Well, still, as we've just heard, the Obama administration has said it's going to appeal the judge's ruling immediately, try to get the moratorium reinstated.
That's right. And in addition, Secretary Salazar says he'll issue a new order in the coming days that eliminates any doubt that a moratorium is needed. He continues to maintain the decision to impose a moratorium on deep water drilling was the right thing to do.
So has the White House shown any interest in a compromise along the lines of what the engineers were talking about?
Well, I'm told by one of these engineers, Ken Arnold, an oil and gas consultant from Houston, that this group is having ongoing discussions with Secretary Salazar about adjustments to the blanket moratorium. Arnold says the secretary seems receptive, but interior officials won't confirm the meetings are going on. President Obama has indicated that if the commission he has appointed to study this accident can assure him that it's safe to lift the drilling ban early, he'd be willing to do that. The problem is that the committee is just getting organized, and its leaders have suggested they'll need all of 6 months or more to reach any conclusions.
Well, given that the these engineers felt that Salazar misrepresented them, are you surprised that they're even talking to him?
Well, Salazar apologized and says he didn't mean to imply that they were endorsing the blanket six-month moratorium. Ken Arnold says he believes the apology was sincere, and he says he's pleased to have this kind of ongoing dialogue. Now, I should say there were 15 experts who reviewed Salazar's initial recommendations. Eight of them have publicly said they don't agree with the moratorium for the reasons that we've described. But at least one of them believes the moratorium is justified, one of the other seven. Her name is Lois Epstein. She's an oil and gas consultant in Alaska. Epstein says the government's regulatory apparatus at Minerals Management Service is so broken, there's no way the government knows whether deepwater drillers are operating safely. As we know, the head of MMS resigned, and the new director is doing a wholesale reorganization of the agency. Epstein says it will take at least 6 months, she says, until the government gets its regulatory system in shape. Deepwater drilling in the Gulf just won't be safe.
John, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
NPR's John Itzde. Okay, is Night and Day worth seeing? Here's film critic Kenneth Turan.
Why is everyone giving Tom Cruise such a hard time? Can't we just forget about what happened on Oprah's couch? Does the movie business have so many stars that it can afford to eat its young? I don't think so. If you doubt Cruise's skills in the star department, Night and Day will make you a believer. This is by no means a perfect film, but it is the most entertaining made-for-adult studio movie of the summer. And the reason it works is Tom Cruise. He is Secret Agent Roy Miller, someone who does everything better when he's wearing sunglasses.
I have contained the situation.
Situation?
Yeah, we've lost the pilots.
Where did they go?
I mean, they're dead.
Night and Day is a romantic thriller that very much wants to duplicate the success of Alfred Hitchcock Entertainment's like North by Northwest and To Catch a Thief. It co-stars Cameron Diaz, who supplies her own kind of charisma as the innocent bystander who gets in way over her head in spy versus spy shenanigans.
Airtime!
Airtime!
Night and Day features a ton of action, including a wild car motorcycle chase through Seville's winding streets.
Take the guns.
Okay.
The film is fortunate to have James Mangold in charge. Mangold directed Walk the Line and 310 to Yuma. And he's one of the few directors who has an instinct for intelligent popular entertainment. His films don't end up on 10 best lists, but you walk out of them feeling you've gotten what you paid for. Roy Miller is not only a peerless action machine, he is also an unflappable and unfailingly polite gentleman. Always ready with a comforting remark or a compliment, no matter how chaotic the situation. Cruise's charming facility with Miller's deadpan spy side manner is this film's secret weapon, and yet another reason why we should put Oprah's couch in storage once and for all.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times.
The recent revelation that Newsweek magazine is on the auction block has again raised questions about the viability of the weekly news magazine. Yet NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik found editors at another venerable weekly, Time, who are telling a very different story about profits and growing circulation.
On the 23rd floor of the historic Time Life building, in a conference room looking out over Midtown Manhattan, editors are vying for space within the nation's leading news magazine.
I'm in the baseball
game. Yeah, I don't want to do baseball. Let's do Afghanistan. We've got a dirty pelican on the cover. We'll have Afghanistan in a moment.
Time managing editor Rick Stengel is guiding a team of editors in pinning down what stories will go into the print edition, and for that matter, what will appear in the special edition that's shipped electronically to Apple.
So let's talk about what iPad-only stuff is. The Haiti video.
Rick Stengel says Time re-engineered itself a few years ago changing its publication date to Fridays, ginning up more content for the web, and reducing its circulation to a core audience that's more appealing to advertisers, 3.2 million paid subscribers.
Not so much people who are trying to find out the latest bit of information about how many points did Blanche Lincoln win by, but people who are looking for context, who are looking for larger meaning.
Editors say their subscriber base has grown in the past year, but there is a school of thought gaining currency in journalism circles that says that's just a mirage. Alan Mutter is a news consultant and Silicon Valley entrepreneur.
The idea of a magazine that waits till the end of the week and wraps it up, that's an anachronism in a world when people are consuming news left and right. If you aim to be informed, it's pretty hard not to be informed.
The problem is, Mutter says, by the time it's in Time, everything new is old news.
I'm in the media soup every day of the week. I find out about things that are important one way or another, and if Time has an important story, I will find out about it very quickly. But do I sit and go through Time either in print or on the web to make sure I know everything they have in it? I do not.
Time doesn't release its profits, but it made an estimated $40 million last year, and Stengel says it will make more money this year than last. Time's competitors are in rough shape. Business Week was sold to Bloomberg News for a few million dollars. U.S. News and World Report? It's now a monthly, not a weekly. Newsweek was losing tens of millions of dollars a year, so it reinvented itself to be more of a journal of opinion and analysis. But last month, Newsweek was put up for sale. According to Mutter and others, Time still can make money for a while in a diminished field, but has few prospects for the future.
Well, that's the conventional wisdom. I don't agree with it.
Former Businessweek editor-in-chief Stephen Shepard is now dean of the Graduate School of Journalism for the City University of New York.
They have to do original stories. They have to do enterprising journalism. They have to do trend stories. They have to do investigative stories. They have to do things that people can't get elsewhere. And if they do that a significant amount of the time, they can be successful.
Shepard points to the success of The Week, The Economist, and even Time's sister publication, People. Time executive editor Nancy Gibbs, a revered writer there for 25 years, says the magazine has always been a curator of news first reported by others and has always picked the news readers should know.
The discipline has always been not what do you cover, but what do you not cover. It has always been an exercise in ignoring things, in saying that's not important enough, or that's not interesting enough, or that's not surprising enough. And this was true 80 years ago, and it's true now.
So Time draws on deep journalistic resources to cover wars, the economy, and the BP oil spill, but has also served up cover stories on Glenn Beck, Jay Leno, and the value of exercise. Time managing editor Rick Stengel says Time is more relevant than ever.
I mean, I'm a big believer that nothing actually ever goes away. I mean, people still make pottery. They still write epic poetry. Beautiful print magazines will always exist, but you will have a lot of different options to get Time's content.
In the future, Stengel says, he'll be happy even if most readers know little more about Time's print edition than they do about ancient Greek verse, as long as they're paying for the magazine's electronic touch tablet editions. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.